G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Massett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackie.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. Thank you so much to everybody who downloaded the last one. We had a record number of, was it uploads or downloads? I think it's downloads. But anyway, it was a record number of listeners. So I think we're heading in the right direction, which is great news. Today we have one guest, and that is Scottish international Asa Hartford, who, of course, people of my age might remember had a transfer stop because they discovered he had a hole in his heart. So he's going to touch on that and just talk about his career and how football has changed over the years and what he's doing here in Australia. But anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And as usual, we're going to have two topics to discuss. And I believe, John, you're starting us off today.
Well, the big one, as far as I can tell at the moment in sport, at least in this country, is the cricketers' pay dispute. It's been bubbling away now for months and months. It is almost become a gone with the wind type situation. And where do we all stand at the end of this? Well, currently we have unemployed cricketers, although it must be fair to say they weren't sacked, and when you term them unemployed, their contracts ran out. So many, many, many people within the community have contracts run out and they find themselves without employment. So it's not like we should be shedding too many tears for the cricketers. It's what happens in a lot of industries. People find themselves without a job suddenly. Well, what I find interesting about the situation is that it's been presented to us as a battle of ideologies. One between the chairman of the Cricketers Australia, David Peaver, who is also the former managing director of Rio Tinto, and the CEO of the Cricketers Association, Alistair Nicholson. And many people are drawing the parallel between Mr. Peaver's former role in busting unions with Rio Tinto and what he's currently trying to do to the Australian Cricketers Association. Now, that's a very interesting question, Ashley. Is it an ideological battle in place here? And is it two minds that are intrinsically are going to be opposed to each other over an ideological idea? Or is it, you know, being made a mountain out of a molehill? I don't know.
Look, I think in today's world, there are a lot of unions who've lost the reason why they were actually there. I do think in sport, though, a lot of the unions are still representing their members properly, whereas in some other areas of life, the unions use their positions for political gain rather than for their members. In this case, I think the players are being looked after, and in a lot of sporting cases, that is the case. I think the players do need a union. I think they need to be looked after. But I think there's so much more to this. I mean, Ian Chappell came out and said, you know, that he felt that the game was over-administered. He used the number 600 employees from Cricket Australia, and that was not counting players. And you think, that's a heck of a lot of people when you consider, you know, the game as a whole. And, okay, they're all based around Australia in the various state bodies. But to me, it's still a lot of people, and that's chewing up a lot of money that could be spent on grassroots cricket, which is one of the complaints that they've got, is they want to see more investment at the bottom. And let's be honest, the stocks coming through have not been that great in recent times. Sure, there are some good players around the Sheffield Shield competition that have been there for a while, and you will still find players coming through, but I do think there needs to be more investment at the bottom end.
Oh, I think that runs across all sports as well. I think we're seeing in a lot of sports, a lot of money is being wasted at the top end and not enough being spent at the bottom end. And they're starting to discover a lot of these sports that, you know, they've got a real weakness in what's coming through in the future because they haven't invested in the bottom end of the scale. And I think what you'll find, especially in a sport like cricket, is the 2020 revolution is not going to help cricket at all. It's going to put money in some players' pockets and into the pockets of broadcasters, but for the game on the whole, it's not going to help Uckercombe West Junior Cricket Club. They're not getting a new kid out of it.
But the thing that T20 is, they've already now done a review on it, and the two things it was there to do were to make people that weren't normally involved in cricket get involved in cricket, and to boost the numbers of playing, that people would start getting interested, and also get interested in other forms of the game, like Test cricket. They've already done a report on that came out in 2016, which proved it had failed on all three levels. So to me, why would you continue investing in it? Sure, it's bringing money. They've announced it's losing money. So why would you invest so much in that? It has to be spent down the bottom of the game. And the other thing, and you know I've been banging on about this one for a long time, is I want to see account. We complain in sections of life when government throw money at areas and then we find out that the money was simply squandered, that someone never actually got to the people it was intended to. Sport is a prime example. The amount of money that the governments, state and federal, throw at various sports, and trust me, and it's there for junior development, or it's there for the international team, or to host an event, but how much of that money is chewed up by the administration and or is spent on administrators' wages, it is appalling. And I think there needs to be a real openness about that, and I think they need to start divulging where the money actually goes, or what it should be is the governing bodies should set these things up and then the government just pays when it's set up and doesn't give the money in advance. I mean, it's something I feel very strongly about these days.
World Cup bid, anyone? Look, back to the cricket for a second. I'm not sure which side I stand on it, because I can understand certain arguments from both sides. Okay, they say sport is now a business, you know, blah, blah. Sport is not business. Sport is completely not business, and business has nothing to do with sport. In all honesty, I mean, I know people make up all these wonderful metaphors for it and all that sort of stuff, but they're completely different, and this is a prime case of when these two differences come head to head. Now, on the player side of things, so you'd like a revenue sharing model, that's nice, and you came out and said you'd even be happy to take less money. Well, that's what revenue sharing means. If there's less revenue, you get less money. You're not doing us a favour by coming out and saying that. That's what should happen. Okay, so that's one thing on the player side. On the other, on the player's side, is you want your cake and you want to eat it too. You want your big fat contract from Cricket Australia, and you want to go and be able to play IPL and the Caribbean leagues, and you want to be able to do all these other things and create and all these other revenue streams, right? Well, if you want your revenue sharing model from your employer, then your employer should have the right to tell you that you're not going to go off and play in India for 6 weeks. You're going to stay in Perth and do, or Sydney, and do your rehab. Or you're going to have a rest, because we know how hard the international circuit is for fast bowlers these days. So you boys are going to stay at home and do some rest and relaxation, do some strengthening fitness conditioning work. Okay? And if you want to be a business and you want to be treated like employees, then expect your boss to make demands on employees that every other employee in this country has demanded from their boss. And remember, there's very, very few people in this country that are employees that are on a revenue sharing basis.
But with the revenue sharing, to me, and again, it's another one of my pet things, I think for sport in this country to survive, you have to have a situation where if players have been developed by Cricket Australia and they've played under 17s, under 19s, or come through the state development ranks, and then they go and play in the IPL, there is a percentage that should come back, as you're talking about revenue sharing, should come back to Cricket Australia so that they can invest in the next generation. Now, if you're a David Warner and you've come through that program, and I'm just being hypothetical here, but he's on one of the biggest contracts in the IPL where he earns a million or whatever it is. So you think, well, okay, if you're on that, you're not going to mind giving up, or I wouldn't think you would. If you've come through that program, if you love Australian cricket enough, you'll go, you know what, I'm happy to give up 200,000 if it means that the next generation coming up behind me, they get the opportunities that I've got. Because at the end of his career, he's going to have enough there if he invests wisely and he does properly. But we need to protect the game. And at the moment, there's too many people, and it's not just in Australia, it's the world over. They're just taking out of the game and then not reinvesting back in. And I just think Australia's not a big enough population to survive that. And I've been saying for a long time, AIS athletes who go on and make, we should follow the PGA model in America, where they have to give 2% or whatever it is back to the PGA after they earn their first $500,000 or whatever. And it would just put sport in this country in so much better a position. And in this case, I think it would put Cricket Australia in a much better position.
Just on the idea that Mr. Peaver is conducting a personal industrial relations vendetta. He's quoted on the Cricket Australia, cricket.com website, that it is a complete myth and deeply insulting to many people across the cricket spectrum. It has been deliberately fabricated by those seeking to portray cricket as an industrial relations battleground and pushed out for the explicit purpose of undermining Cricket Australia's case for modest but necessary changes to the current player payment model. The suggestion that Cricket Australia's push to modify the player payments model has nothing to do with genuine issues facing the game is an insult to everyone involved at CA, including other members of the board. And I think there is a lot of truth in that, but I also do think that Mr. Peaver has an ideological bent about the way things should be run. That's not to say that it's the overriding cause for this situation to have arisen.
Look, I think sport has to evolve, and I think the other thing is we've got to look at, and I read a really interesting article a few months ago about how chairs of the boards around the world, not just in sport, but are getting far too involved in the day-to-day running of the business and the sport. And I think this is something we've got to be very careful. Why are we paying CEOs over $1 million if the chairman or the president of the board is interfering? They are just there to make sure that the pathway that is being taken by the CEO is correct, and they've followed due diligence to make sure that the accounts are right and everything is being run according to the way it should be run. And they also determine direction. But it is the board who does, it is the CEO who should be doing the strategic plan, not the board. And I think some boards are getting way too involved and stretching over into an area that they shouldn't be going down. Because then if they get rid of the CEO, to me then the board is as culpable as well and should go as well as the CEO.
It's interesting that this is seen as perhaps by some as an industrial relations dispute, because I wonder how many people who are standing on the cricketers' side in this particular pay dispute would stand on the side of a union up against Rio Tinto in a pay dispute where they are attempting to use collective bargaining to strike a deal. Now that's what the players are doing; they're using collective bargaining. For a lot of people, if it was a boot scutter, whatever, they would be unhappy that this person thought that they could take on the collective bargaining agreement and unions. A lot of people hate unions. And I wonder how many of those people who hate unions are actually on the cricketers' side in this dispute.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one. It's unfortunate for the sport, but we're going to have to keep following it and see how it all plays out down the track.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, as I mentioned, we've got one guest coming up on the show today, and that is Asa Hartford. He played for Scotland at two World Cups, played for Manchester City and West Bromwich Albion, as well as short spells with Nottingham Forest and Everton. And I was a big fan of Asa Hartford. I thought he was a silky midfielder in his day. So when I heard he was in town, I had to try and find out why he was in Perth and also just look back on his career. Asa Hartford, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Oh, thanks very much, Ash. Great to be here.
Well, I've got to ask you this first up, because Asa's not that common a name, and I read somewhere that your dad was a big Al Jolson fan, and that's where you got your name. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, there's not many people who remember that far back, but he was an Al Jolson fan, and he died. His name was Asa Jolson, but his stage name was Al Jolson, and he died the night before I was born, so that's why I got stuck with that.
Do you like it or not?
Well, yeah, you just get on with it, you know. And, I mean, my first name's Richard. And where I come from, in a town called Claybank, you know, there's not many people get called Richard, you know. So Asa was much better.
Well, you mentioned you grew up in Scotland, but the interesting thing was you didn't play for a professional team in Scotland before you were signed by West Bromwich Albion. How did that come about?
No, you're right, I didn't play, but I was only 15, and in those days you couldn't sign for a Scottish club at that age. And in any case, I wanted to come to England to play football because I knew the leagues were better. And it was like, just to get to England, it was any club would have done, really. And in fact, when it was the West Brom scout came to my parents' house, they asked for permission for me to go down for a trial. And of course, like, I said to him, yeah, I want to do that, you know, to my mum and dad. As soon as the scout had left, I had to get the Atlas out to find out where West Bromwich was.
Well, you obviously worked out where West Brom was in the end. And did you enjoy your time there?
Oh, yeah, I had a fantastic time. I was there for about 8 years, you know, so probably you could say I grew up around there. It didn't always go that well, you know. I think leaving home at 15, I'd never been out of Clydebank, Scotland. So it was quite difficult in the early days because I was in digs, you know, living with different people. Some were better than others. But, soon settled in. I think the football helped. And I made a few friends at, you know, that I'm still friendly with to this day, like Len Cantello, who played at West Brom. Dave and I are friends with him.
The one thing that probably marks your career, and you're probably sick of talking about it, was obviously your transfer to Leeds that never happened.
And at the time it was just a surprise because I was 21 and Don Howe was the West Brom manager and he was a bit of a hard taskmaster and keep us fit. And so lots of running and cross countries and stuff like that. And I was as fit as a fiddle, you know, as far as I knew. So it came as a massive shock.
I mean, for those people that don't know, you went to Leeds, you had a medical, and they reckoned you had a hole in the heart, and yet you were due to play that weekend.
I actually signed for them on a Wednesday. I went back to West Brom to get my boots and stuff and some clothes together, and then travelled up to Leeds on a Thursday night, trained with them on a Friday morning. And in those days, like the team, they gave us a yellow jersey, which signifies like you've had, you know, you're the worst player on the team. And after training, that's when I went for the medical. So it was a bit, you know, wrong way round, if you like. And then that's when it was detected. I think it was an ECG where it showed up. And Don Revy, the Leeds manager, just asked me to come back early on a Saturday morning just for another little test. And it was obviously to confirm that there was a hole in the heart. And that's when the transfer was declined.
Did you feel your world was coming to an end then, or...?
No, I possibly should have, but it didn't make sense to me because I was 21. I was doing cross countries and maybe being in the top half dozen, you know, at the club. So it just didn't make sense to me. And I went straight back to West Brom on that Saturday. And I think on the Monday, by the Monday or the Tuesday, I was in the hospital in Birmingham having tests done. You know, and in those days, the specialist. He said, in his opinion, that it wasn't bad enough, you know, for me to give up playing football, which was really reassuring, you know, because normally they err on the side of caution.
I read a story where it was saying how you were driving back and suddenly you thought, I better tell my girlfriend and my parents, but of course there were no mobile phones in those days.
Yeah, that's right. It was coming down the M62, and it was about 11 o'clock in the morning when I'd been told, so I was driving back, and I heard the news on the radio that my transfer had been declined. You know, I thought, oh, crikey, I better, you know. But I couldn't get through to you either. I tried to phone my mum and dad and my girlfriend, just couldn't get through. And the press boys had got there ahead of me.
What were your parents' reaction?
Shocked. I mean, when I was a young kid, they'd taken us to the doctor for one reason. The doctor had said that I'd had a heart murmur. But, you know, that wouldn't, you know, cause any problems.
As it probably turned out, though, it was a blessing in disguise because you eventually were signed by Man City and that seemed to be just a perfect marriage for you.
I think it was about 3 years later. Immediately after I went back to West Brom, like the players there said, well, that's you, like, that's you here forever. You know, the build is standing around you because you're never getting away. But so it was 3 years later before Manchester City came in. And even then, I was worried because I still had the hole in the heart situation. But, you know, thankfully they took a chance.
Man City, though, again, they played some beautiful football in those days and had some really good players. Did you feel that it was a team that played football that suited your style?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the early... late 60s, early 70s, they probably had the best ever team, City. You know, when they won the FA Cup in 68 and the League 69 and this, that and the other. And I joined them in 74. There was one or two coming towards the end of the career, you know. Dennis Law, Mike Summerby, Franny, Francis Lee. I think I signed and then Francis left and went to Derby, which was quite ironic because then Derby won the league, you know, the league that year.
And you won the League Cup in 76 with famous Dennis Stewart overhead to win the game.
Yeah, it was a great goal. Can't remember, I think it was Willie Donaghy crossed it and Joe Royal headed it back. It's just one of those goals at Wembley that you don't forget.
You mentioned Derby winning the league, and obviously Brian Clough then went from Derby via Brighton to Notts Forest, and he signed you there. Was that again a bit of a surprise when that call came?
No, not really. It wasn't a surprise because I'd known about it for about 2 months. I mean, I probably shouldn't say, but everyone knows it goes on. You get tapped up, and I'd been tapped up by his assistant, Peter Taylor. And so I knew in advance that they were going to come in for me. But it obviously didn't work out because I only played the first three league games of the season. And then I was on my bike.
I mean, that seemed really strange. What happened there?
I'm not quite sure, you know, because they just won the European Cup. So they were a fantastic side. But I think when they won it, they signed two players. They signed a left-back, Frankie Gray, and to replace Frank Clark, who was like a defensive fullback. Frank Gray was an attacking fullback. They signed me to replace Archie Gemmell, which was a mistake because Archie would still played in the Premier League or the First Division in those days for another 3 years. So it was probably a mistake. But when I was playing, I think when I would be Brian Clough liked his teams to be like play 4-4-2 and you stayed in your position, you know, and everything seemed to go through. John Robertson on the left, who's like a fantastic player. And I think I maybe just wasn't getting enough of the ball that I wanted. And I might have been a bit indisciplined and maybe going towards the right back or somewhere else to get on the ball. And Cluffy didn't like it. So that's just the way he was. He makes his mind up. And that was it. But I mean, I was 27. So I wasn't a young lad. He knew like what I could do and what I couldn't do. So it was a bit strange.
The other irony, I think, there is when you made your debut for Scotland, you were a replacement for Archie Gemmell there, wasn't it, against Peru?
I'm not sure. Well, I'll take your point if you say so. I can't remember, but it was against Peru, in 1972. I didn't know that.
Well, that's what I read up before, so there you go. I mean, do you think that you and Archie were similar players? Because to me, you were very different players, actually, really.
Yeah.
I think you were a little bit silkier than him.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think he'd like...
I'm sure he
yeah,
would.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good job he's not out here. No, he was a good player. He's probably more... He would run more with the ball. And he could be... If you remember his goal in Argentina, he beat three or four players. I mean, he didn't... He was not a goal-scoring midfield player, but he's probably more of a dribbler, where I would be maybe considered a passer.
Yeah, that's how I sort of remember it. I mean, 78 World Cup, again, it's the one probably everyone in Scotland remembers. It's the one, probably people say, the one that got away. I mean, you were part of that team. Did you go over there really believing you had a chance?
I don't know about a chance, but we had a good squad, there was no doubt, because we played the home international games, you know, at the end of the season. And I think we'd won it in 77 and 78. So we had a good squad. But just one reason or another, it just didn't happen for us. We didn't know. I mean, our first game was against Peru in the World Cup, and we didn't know anything about their team. You know, and even in the 70s, you should have known. I mean, they had two wingers that I think they could have done 100 metres standard time, you know, two flying machines, but nobody knew anything about them. And Kubilis, like Nani Kubilis, they had good players, but we just didn't know anything about them.
Was that really the story of that campaign? Was it just the preparation just wasn't up to scratch?
Yeah, I think so. And even the sort of accommodation. And in the end, we had to travel like 30 miles or something like that to go training, you know. And it just wouldn't happen nowadays, you know. You'd have a base near somewhere where you train and the hotel would be up to scratch. But even that in Argentina wasn't very good. It wasn't well organised.
Must have been a huge disappointment, but you did get a second bite at a World Cup in 82. I mean, what are your memories of that?
Yeah, I only played one game there. We got, it was against Brazil. and I'm trying to think, it was in Seville, it was roasting hot, and Scotland took the lead through David Neary, who
didn't score,
yeah, I think he scored with his left foot, maybe his only goal ever with his left foot, but that seemed to upset the Brazilians, you know, because they then turned it on and ended up beating his 4-1. But it was great, because they didn't win the World Cup, but they could have, you know, they had some fantastic players, you know, like Falcao in midfield and Socrates, and Eder, they're great players.
They did indeed. Now, you mentioned the home nations, which obviously doesn't happen anymore, and I mean, you actually personally, I saw, had a really good record against England in your time.
I think won a couple at Wembley, 77 and 79. I think I played in five, so it's about level. I think there was lost a couple, drew one, and then we won 77, 79. I mean, 77 was the one where the fans invaded the pitch and pulled down the crossbar and dug up the pitch. You know, so.
Did you know that was going on when you were down in the changing rooms?
No, it was only afterwards. You come up in the tunnel and go over to the halfway line where the Royal Box was, to go and get a cup of tea or a bottle of beer or something like that, and then just seeing the state of the pitch, it was just unbelievable.
Well, what were your thoughts then? Did you think, oh dear, this isn't going to happen again?
Well, we thought there's going to be trouble about it, but I think what it was, the most of them probably inebriated, to be fair, but I don't think there was damage to the, obviously damage, but there was no anger, you know, there was no fighting and anything like that, so I think that's why they just about got away with it.
A little bit over-exuberant, maybe, is probably the best way to put it.
Like, it's funny, the next 2 years later, in 79, Scotland won 1-0, and I'd only played about half an hour, and Viv Anderson sort of bumped his, you know, as it happens in the game, and I slipped and dislocated my elbow. So I was off the pitch, say, 35 minutes, and got in the dressing room, and the physios came in with me and then left, but my friend who had been at the game actually got in the dressing room. He was there with me, you know, like a guy that I've known from school days, and he was still in the dressing room when Jock Stein came in and gave the half-time team talk, and you just think that just wouldn't happen today. But after half-time, the team went out for the second half and had to go to a hospital, and there was two physios with the Scottish team, and neither of them came with me. The two of them wanted to stay and watch the game, so my mate took me in the ambulance down to Middlesex Hospital. Strange.
And I did read that you came back to the ground to get your kit, and then you had to walk through all the fans as they were leaving, which would never happen today.
No, that's a taxi driver from the hospital took us as far as he could get, because we were getting towards the end of the game, and so we had to. I was running my kit with my arm in a sling, and you got all these drunk Scottish fans coming out saying, "Well done, wee man," and patting you on your arm, you know. No one, it's just as well I got by, because I can't see anyone else who's going to pick up all my stuff.
I mean, it's very different times, and in those days, do you think now the players are too isolated, that there isn't that contact that you guys had?
Yeah, there is. You don't, I mean, in our day, you had much more contact with the player, you know, like in supporters club meetings, or at Manchester City, it would be Junior Blues, or you could go, you could bump into a player in a pub, but I don't know. You know, where would you go and bump into a Premier League player these days? I don't know.
Yeah. You mentioned Cabeas, and you played with him in America as well. I mean, how good a player was he? Because obviously Peru, you don't think of as being a place where great players come from.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, well, he obviously was. You know, he operated at the highest level. But in the States, it was when I was there, it wasn't the top league that had just folded. It was I can't even remember the name of the league, but he played, but he only played the home games at Fort Lauderdale. He didn't travel, he didn't go on the road, you know, because he had soccer camps, you know, so he was picking up money there.
You're involved now in coaching young players. Are you enjoying that? You had a short spell in management, but is this easier than the sitting on the bench?
Yeah, but I haven't really coached for a few years. I ended up at Accrington Stanley, which was quite an experience, you know. But I enjoyed it. You know, it was good experience. And still looking, for the last few years, I've been scouting for Norwich. Although that's just finished because there's a new sporting director going into Norwich and there's been a new manager appointed. So the structure behind the scenes has changed. So I finished with them just about 2 weeks ago, apparently, you know, because no one told me about that in the email. You know, that's the way they do it these days, you know. But still interesting, yeah. Looking for good players.
Well, you scored a goal in the cup final for Norwich, didn't you? I mean, I think Mick Shannon described that as he went there for a holiday and ended up winning the cup.
Yeah, he did. Well, it was against Sunderland and it was deflected. And I always say, like, if it hadn't been deflected, the keeper could have laid down, had a cup of tea and a fag and still caught the ball, you know. But it deflected off someone into the other corner. And after the game, Mick says, you've got to claim that goal because it was, you know. And they said, if you don't, I will. You know what I mean? That's what strikers were, you know. They were all like that. They're all greedy, weren't they? But I'm not sure if I've been... Some people say that I did, you know, it's credited. I know, certainly from the kick-off, Sunderland were kicking off, and I looked up, it was the old Wembley, used to be the scoreboard. And it had, you know, like, Sunderland 0, Norwich 1, and you see it flicking up... goal scorer, and I thought, oh, I'm going to see my name here, and it went Chisholm OG because it came off somebody's backside. Thought I was going to get my name up in lights.
So you've spent time in Australia. What have you been doing here, and how have you found it?
It's my first time in Australia. Came to look up some friends, some old friends. Well, I had a couple of weeks. It's three or four of us in it. We're watching a few games. There was a couple of young lads that have went to Platinum Academy in Liverpool. It's run by Dave Mannix, you know, he's an ex-Liverpool player, and I've done a little bit of stuff over there with him. So we're just catching up with the two boys that were there last season, whose names escaped my memory right now. But just to see how they answer what the general standard is, and see if there's anything that would be good enough to get back into, you know, maybe Platinum Academy.
Well, Ace, a great catching up with you, and we wish you a safe trip home.
All right. Thanks very much, Axley. Nice to meet you after hearing a lot about you from Peter Barnes.
Thanks very much.
All right. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not The Footy Show.
And it's funny you should play that, John, because while I was sitting with Asa Hartford, who we just listened to there, he was talking about Gordon Banks and saying how he was, in his mind, far and away the greatest goalkeeper the game's ever seen. And he was saying the save from Pelé was just amazing. And he was also telling an interesting story about when they unveiled the statue to Gordon Banks at the Britannia Stadium, the home of Stoke City. And if you remember, we had Gordon Banks on the show when that happened. And he was there for that game, and he said it was amazing because Pelé was the coach of one team, Gordon Banks was the coach of the other. And Pelé, he said, I'd only ever sort of seen him, I'd never played against him, but he goes, his assistant coach on that day was Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and he said he was just amazing. He said, what a great guy, so funny. He said he pretty much stole the show. He goes, but what a brilliant guy. And I mean, I'm sure it would have been very strange for some of the footballers to see Archbishop Desmond Tutu running up and down on the side of the pitch.
I can just hear that voice, kick it.
So no, but it was great to catch up with Asa Hartford, and good to hear that the hole in his heart actually came to nothing, and he had a long and prosperous career. And Leeds United, some fans still say that was maybe a big mistake when they let him slip through their hands because of that medical. And football is the subject I'm going to talk about this week, John. I mean, I can't help it because the FFA still look like they're headed for intervention from FIFA and the AFC. And that this normalisation committee is going to be enforced on the FFA. And it's just, you just think, what a mess. You know, the game has only been run by the FFA now since 2005. So we're 12 years and we're almost back to the same mess that it was before they disbanded the old Soccer Australia.
Normalisation process. Would just give us a quick rundown of...
Well, what it means is FIFA will put their own people in charge to try and sort out... They will sack the board and they'll put their own people in charge of football in Australia for the time being, and they've already announced who the panel is, and the funny thing is one of them is a North Korean, so you're thinking, that's actually not a democratic country, but you're saying that the FFA is not democratic, so the processes need to be more democratic. But anyway, that's a whole different argument, but it does sort of make you raise your eyebrows a little bit. The big issue is on the voting rights, because the A-League clubs want to at the moment they have one vote at board level. All of the state bodies have a vote, and then they're advocating the FFA that the W-League will have a vote, and then it was going to be also the Players Association was going to have a vote. Well, the Players Association at the moment are on the outer, so the vote is not on the table. The W-League is a big question, because there's only one W-League club that is not owned by an A-League club, and that happens to be Canberra United, but they're owned by Capital Football, which is a state body who also already has a vote. So there's a lot of conjecture there that, in fact, you're giving one body two votes when they should be having one. But what worries me is, again, and I always say this, you have to go back and look at history before you can find solutions. And the big problem is, if you look at football in the past, it was a struggle for power. We saw the state bodies fighting for votes, and New South Wales, because they did it on a pro rata basis for a while on how many players you had registered. So New South Wales controlled football, and it was always a battle between New South Wales and Victoria, because they had the population base, so they had the most votes, so they controlled what happened. Now, the Crawford report said that's not good, it should be one vote, one association. Should the A-League clubs have more votes? You can understand why they want it, you know, in that these people are investing a lot of money into a competition where they're losing money at the moment, and, you know, they've only got one vote, so they're not having much influence. It's a really difficult one. It needs to be worked out. I mean, there is, of course, a push, and Football Victoria has said, well, they will support the FFA's vote structure that they're putting forward as long as they create a genuine second division to the A-League. And, of course, the FFA has agreed to that in principle at the moment. I'm sure as soon as they get what they want, it'll go out the window, but that's just my view of that. So it's a really, really difficult one. But what worries me is we're going to actually see the voting go back to the old way, where there's going to be a select few are going to actually hold the power. So what it could be is, if you look, the A-League clubs going to hold the power, and if we look at how many A-League clubs are in New South Wales, so you've got Newcastle Jets, you've got Central Coast Mariners, got Sydney United, got Western Sydney Wanderers, so there's four of them there. You've got two clubs in Melbourne, and then you've got the Victorians, so there's seven votes potentially, you know, in those states. Eight votes, so they could actually then control football with those eight votes if you gave all the A-League clubs and the state bodies. And is that good for football? One of the things, just finally, that concerns me is the silence coming out of our state body. And I think there should have been more communication from them as to where they stand on this, in that Football Victoria has been vocal, Football New South Wales have been very open about how they stand. To be fair to Football West, Football Queensland have been very quiet, Football South Australia have been very quiet. But this is where we need, as people who love the game, players, coaches need to know where your stance is, or should you in fact be asking those clubs and the standing committees and the zone reps what the clubs feel and voting according to that. And to me, that is what should be happening, but it's not.
If the government was to pull all funding for football in this country away, where would that leave the game? Would the game be able to survive?
No.
Okay, I'm just wondering about what the ramifications of having FIFA walk in and take over the control of the game are, considering how much money FIFA makes, and blokes can make £100,000 a week out of football if you're in the right country. You know, would there be room here for the government to say, well, if you want to run the sport, you can pay for the sport?
Look, the government could say that. I mean, the other thing that the FFA could face is you could find the Socceroos banned from international football because of the way the game has been run here. That is a very, very real proposition, and it has happened to two other countries, and off the top of my head at the moment, I've just forgotten who they are, in the last year. So, you know, we may find
ourselves... One of them is not North Korea, though, is it?
No, it's not. But it, you know, and it's a very real prospect that we could face that. But I think something has to be done, and what upsets me is the fact that everybody praised Frank Lowy and said Frank Lowy was the saviour, Frank Lowy was this. I was one of the few people who spoke out
very early in the piece that Frank Lowy, to me, yes, he managed to get the year of government. Yes, he got the money to get us to have a bid for the World Cup. We've shown now, it's been proven that that was flawed. I think also what he did was he did exactly the same thing as the previous administration did. He gambled on us qualifying for the World Cup in 2005 when he brought Gus Hiddink in. It cost him $1 million to give Gus Hiddink the job. It cost him another $1 million for Gus Hiddink when he qualified, and it cost another $1 million on top of that for Gus Hiddink when he got out of the group stage. Now, you wonder why the players weren't paid until something like 9 months after their World Cup appearances. It was because there was no money. All of the money went on that qualification. They gambled, and luckily Mark Schwarzer saved, and we went to the World Cup. But if that had not happened, football would be in a very, very different position now. So I don't think necessarily the management was that great at that point in time. They just got lucky that they qualified, and then they were able to build. The A-League, yes, give them credit. They set that up, and it's been successful, but they haven't revitalised it. It is now a stale product, and I don't think they market it very well. As I've said with other sports, some of these governing bodies just do not know how to market the game.
How much is Australian football rely on qualifying for the next World Cup?
Heavily.
I mean, it looks like they're going to. I think they're in the box seat to qualify. But
I think you might be jumping the gun there. I think it's going to go down to. I think it'll go down to the last game against Japan.
You do?
Yeah.
What if they? Because you've got two more games, haven't they? Two. One of them's Japan.
Well, it'll depend on the other results, but it could come down to that last game because there's three teams on the same points at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, we should have expected this. I mean, even though the FFA told us that they were going into Asia to make it easier to qualify, it's hard either way. Doesn't matter which way you go, it's going to be hard to qualify. There's no guarantees.
But again, it comes back to it's going to be hard if you don't invest in grassroots. And they haven't done that. That's one of the big faults with the whole FFA. And now, and this is a subject for another day, they're closing down the Australian Institute of Sport and they're expecting the A-League clubs to develop the next generation. And I don't think many of the A-League clubs are A, in a position to be developing them. They don't really want to develop them. And I just think it's a really, really bad move.
Oh, I agree. It shouldn't be left to the role of, I mean, they're private financial entities. Their job isn't to be developing football players.
Well, it is, but it's meant to be their job to polish them into footballers.
Well, I would say that by the time you're playing in the top league, that you shouldn't be developing players. You, like the term you use, polishing them. You should be turning up at a professional team at that level, being able to play the game already. You might need a couple of little things to work. You might need to change your game slightly to fit what coach wants to do. But the idea that you use those leagues to develop players, I'm sorry, that's rubbish.
Well, it was interesting, again, in conversation with Asa Hartford, our guest on this podcast, he was saying that he was so impressed with the players that he's seen over here in Western Australia from the age 6 to 12. He goes, 6 to 12, they're on a par with all the European kids. He goes, they're really good, their skills are good. He goes, after 12, they fall away dramatically. So what does that tell you? So it says, there's a few things there, but he's going, after that, there are problems in the game. And he goes that something's going wrong when they're hitting 12, 13, because they are all very good players there, but then they're just falling away. The standard then, they are not on par with Europe.
That's interesting that they would come from the same starting point, though. And what would it be that is it coaching? I'm not sure that it's actually coaching that's the problem.
I think it would be a combination of things. I don't think there's one thing you can put your finger on it. It could be coaching, it could be environment, it could be other distractions, it could be the climate here that we live in, such a wonderful place that, you know, there are the options to play other sports and do other things. And, you know, maybe if you've been in an academy situation from the age of 6, a lot of kids go, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm going to go and do something else. And here you have the opportunity, whereas in some countries in Europe, those opportunities aren't there.
Well, in the reality of a global sporting economy, Australia's starting to catch up, and we're starting to find out that it's a much bigger bowl out there than we thought. And there's a lot of problems and issues that all sports are going to have to face in the next few years to try and come to terms with that global sporting economy.
Absolutely. Now, before we wrap up, I've just got one last thing I want to throw in the mix, John. Because obviously the British and Irish Lions tour came to an end. I'm not sure if you saw the decision at the end of the game. Now, Romain Poit made the decision that it should have been a penalty. And people are saying, in the spirit of the game, he made the right decision. Is there a spirit of the game when it comes to laws of the game and interpretation of them?
I thought it was Bundaberg rum for rugby. Isn't that the spirit of the game?
We're no sponsorship messages here, please. But look, it was a great series, and I wrote a piece on the blog notthefootyshow.com because there's been pushes saying that there should have been extra time played in the third test. No, it was a best of three series, so it finished as a draw. That's the way it is. The other thing that everyone's been pushing for is a fourth test to be played in England later in the year. You can't do that. This group of players were together once. The tour is over. They disband. They will never be together again except for a reunion. And so that, I'm afraid, is that.
What's wrong with a draw? Is there something wrong with the draw?
Not in my book.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.